Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is co-host Bridget Kennedy.
Hi, John.
So Bridget, this is your first time on Sophomore Lit. Would you like to tell everyone out there a little bit about yourself?
I am on the podcast, apparently, because I've read basically all of Ayn Rand's fiction works for some reason. Personally, I'm a biochemist and I do pharmaceutical safety testing for a job. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, but this is my first time being on one.
Well, I hope this is just the first of many times you'll be on a podcast. So as you mentioned, this is a podcast about this time about Ayn Rand. I have had a lot of requests over the years for Ayn Rand. Actually, it's a pretty good fit for the podcast, because whatever you think of Ayn Rand, she tends to be an author that people read early in life. And for a certain group of people who read her in their teens or 20s, she can become a lifelong obsession. I think for the rest of us, for people like me who never read her and have only read her now for this podcast, she remains a bit of an enigma. Like, why are people so interested in her? And why does she have such a fervent following? And why are her books so darn long? So, Bridget, tell me a little bit about your history with this book.
So, for Atlas Shrugged, my mother read it and handed it to me to read in eighth grade. And so I read it, and there were things I didn't like about it, but it was really interesting in a way that there was a worldview being presented that I wasn't familiar with. In particular, when you're in eighth grade and you're transitioning into high school eventually, and you're a woman, and if you're smart, it's really, being smart isn't actually always good. And all of a sudden, there was this world of people where being smart was good, being competent was good. And they were fighting against the stream. And so there was a sort of attraction to the intellectualism of what I thought at the time. And I read it pretty closely, I thought, in eighth grade. And coming back to it, I'm going, wow, this is just terrible writing. But it was really foundational for me at the time, because I read all her books in high school then. It just, the fascination I had was really, I think, just feeling separate in a teen and defining yourself with the world. She offers a really attractive view of how to identify yourself with that, to find yourself in it, because all of a sudden you're the most important thing.
So you started with Atlas Shrugged,
yeah.
Which was her last novel from 1957, and her longest novel by a large margin. It's pretty much considered her major novel. She's also known for Anthem and The Fountainhead, which are shorter and perhaps more to the point. And she's known for the books of a philosophy she wrote after, which were not, her ideas were not presented anymore through fiction, but through propositional writing. Yeah, I think that's interesting, because I always assumed that Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand were books that appealed to a certain kind of intelligent young reader who felt like an outcast. Certainly, this book turns that all on its head and makes being intelligent into the sort of the key to power in the world and the key to self-actualization and motivation. And the ugly side of that is also that this is a book that teaches people to think of themselves as particularly special, or Ayn Rand's heroes are the people who are the motivators of the world. They're the people who do things in the world, and everyone else who doesn't do something, who isn't productive, is considered a looter or a moocher,
right,
to Rand. And I think that probably is particularly appealing if you're a teenager who isn't in the in crowd, and you get a little bit of that someday I'm going to show them all kind of idea.
Yeah, there's definitely that. And I also think part of it is that if it defines how you experience the world just purely on your own reaction to it. And if you're smart, it calls that reaction rational and objective. And so then it's like saying that you are the smartest thing and what you are feeling is that. It's confirmation bias. And that's really, that's something a lot of people who don't read this book have trouble not doing as well. So it's this insidious, really attractive view for people. And especially if, say, you're a white, upper middle class white guy, all of a sudden everything that comes to you was justified and rational and objective and wasn't that nice. And here the book says so.
This isn't really a content warning, but this is more like a heads up to the listenership. You know, it's possible quite often to read books by people whose politics you don't agree with and to sort of disassociate yourself from their politics, or who might have been difficult people in life to find admirable, and you can associate their art from the individual. Rand doesn't let you do that.
No, this is ideology plus a story, not story with some ideology. Like,
and Dagny Taggart, the protagonist of the novel, is so obviously a stand-in for Ayn Rand, or at least a wish-fulfillment version of herself, that you can't really disassociate the individual from this book either. So I'm just going to warn everyone, this is going to be a political podcast. So if you don't like that, you know, you could, you know, switch to cereal or something else.
We are living in a moment where politically, I think, mutual aid and the protection of others is a really common theme right now. And so if you're going to read a book about, like, where that says radical self-interest and greed is actually the highest value, I think we should talk about politics. Because like, right now, it's just apropos for the moment of going, maybe there's something wrong with this ideology.
Ayn Rand was originally a Russian, in the sense of born under the Tsar in Russia, lived through the revolution. She came from an observant Jewish family, a bourgeois family which was doing okay in Russia. That was kind of unusual, actually, for a Jewish family to have the kind of economic success that their family had. Whether under the Tsars or under Soviet rule, unfortunately, Russia has not been very kind to its Jewish citizens.
No, right. Her dad was a pharmacist, if I recall correctly.
Rand's family lost a lot of their property after the revolution. Nonetheless, she was able to go to university, to school, and she emigrated out of Russia in the 20s to America, where she got a job working in Hollywood. And she wrote scripts. She wrote her own stuff. She wrote experimental plays. And eventually, she became really successful with the publication of The Fountainhead, that was also made into a movie, I believe.
Yeah, with Gary Cooper.
And then Atlas Shrugged was a pretty decent seller in his day, but I don't think that it actually became the political powerhouse that it is until around the 1980s. This is when one of her proteges, Alan Greenspan, right, became chair of the Federal Reserve. Her ideas directly influenced the economy of this country during the Reagan years. And more recently, of course, Paul Ryan likes to point to Ayn Rand as a major motivator of his own thought.
And Rand Paul.
Objectivism, the philosophy that Rand founded, has become a little more mainstream, I think, since the 80s and 90s. And that's, I think, when you start seeing lots of teenagers going around with copies of Atlas Shrugged in the 90s.
I mean, I think the popularity, it was always sort of underground, I guess. Like, it would sell a lot, but people weren't talking about it. And I know a lot of that was, her ideas were very influential, especially within the Republican Party, but she was very much anti-religious and anti-God, and that was very unattractive for them to admit that they were reading this person who was so anti-religion. So now it's a little more that Paul Ryan can talk about it, and no one seems to care that she was pretty much anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, any of it. So,
have I mentioned this book is very, very long?
It's so long, and I'm so sorry, John.
When I started this, I knew, you know, because Ayn Rand is something of a punchline on the left, you know, for this kind of ridiculously bombastic, self-important, egotistical view that tries to justify the idea that people should not do anything for anyone else because ultimately that is the only good way to live your life. I was curious to actually read her and to see for myself what the process of reading her was like. I had, in fact, played Bioshock, so I felt like I had a pretty good grounding in what Ayn Rand was about. Bioshock is a lot more fun.
Yeah, yeah. Shocking that a video game would be more fun than 1,100 pages of whatever. I mean, it's shocking to me because I read it in eighth grade and got through it and was fascinated by it. And I was reading it and I was listening to the audio at 2x speed to get through it for this. And I was just going, why did I do this? This is it, like the writing is just bad at points, like really bad.
There's a weird dreamlike quality to this book. This book is entirely fabular. Not only because it gives it has a strong moral to it, but also because it exists in a sort of a magical world in which everything is simplified and people's personalities are heightened. It's a strange world. It was written in 1957, but it sort of feels a bit like the 1890s in that everyone in this story is an industrialist, but that means that they are building trains or they are involved in metallurgy or oil fields. Her vision of what industrial production is sort of like Karl Barks's vision of what a millionaire duck would be with Uncle Scrooge, you know, that everyone is living in these polished Art Deco mansions, and they're all talking to each other about doing a business, as Vincent Adultman would say.
Yo, I know. That's the whole time. I kept thinking her perception of business is Adultman on BoJack. It was like, I kept thinking, she doesn't know what business is. She doesn't know what engineering or science are. She just goes, yes, this is science. Like,
and on the one hand, you could say that's fine because she's trying to use these... she's trying to use her imagery to support her theme. But on the other hand, it's not fine because if her point is that rational scientific minds, that inventors and artists are the true motivators of society, and yet she has no real understanding of these things.
It's a problematic worldview. It's not a worldview based on evidence, which is what she claims it is.
There's an Aesop's fable that is not well known, which is a lion and a man are arguing about which species is better, humans or lions. And the man says, look, I'll prove to you that humans are better. And he takes the lion and he shows him a statue of a hunter killing a lion. And he says, look, there's. And the lion says, that doesn't prove anything. If lions could build statues, I'd make a statue of a lion eating a person. That's what I felt about this book, is like she's creating such odd straw men all over the place. Yeah. and a world that doesn't really exist.
Well, did you read her final conclusion to the book about the author section?
No, I did not.
Okay, let me get this pull this quote up for you because it's really indicative of what I think the problem is with her. She goes, I trust that no one will tell me that men such as I write about don't exist. That this book has been written and published is my proof that they do. like I can write a book about aliens. That doesn't mean that aliens are real.
I don't want to be the nerdy explaining guy, but there's a lot of points throughout this book where anyone with the slightest understand. I mean, I'm not an engineer. The last course I had in natural sciences was geology, I think my sophomore year in college. But there's a lot of points in this book where I just like, I was reading it off of a Kindle, so I couldn't actually throw it across the room. But one of the early points in the book is that Dagny Taggart, who is the beautiful and dashing protagonist, the Skyan daughter of the Taggart fortune, who's running the Taggart railroads, and the only one who is actually carrying her weight in this organization, she wants to build a new railroad line to go to Colorado, because she realizes that that's where the money is. The other people want to build railroad lines to Mexico, and she knows that's a fool's errand because Mexico is going to nationalize all the railroads. She wants to go with this new metal alloy created by Dick Reardon.
By Hank Reardon.
And the reason she wants to go with it is because it is stronger than anything that exists and lighter than anything exists. And
right.
We aren't told what it's made from. It's just called Reardon metal. And at one point, someone says about the metal, it has a melting point of 4,000 degrees.
What are the units on that?
Right. Well, the question I have is like, well, what do you forge it in then? Because like steel is forged at like 2,500 degrees. You'd have to have a forge that could withstand that. I don't know what you would have that would withstand that. Maybe unless, I mean, NASA had not invented the ceramic tiles for the space shuttle at that point. Later in the book, she and Reardon come to this abandoned factory.
And they find the static electricity engine.
First of all, they find this abandoned factory that is just there. And they just walk in, they waltz in, and they walk around with their flashlights. And of course, they're both able to immediately tell what this thing is and what it means. And it's supposedly an engine that runs on static electricity. And I think to myself, how much electricity do they think is in air?
So, the heavy sigh. The other thing that really bothers me about that scene is there's enough text there, like some sort of lab notebook, to determine what it was, and she's got enough of the engine to figure out that what it was supposed to do and vaguely how it worked. But then she decides that there's no way from the available evidence she'll be able to deduce how it works. And so then she spends like all this time in the novel finding someone to do it, and everyone keeps saying, there's just a first principle we're missing. And I'm just going, that's not how science works. Like, it's not. It's like in.
you've encapsulated in one sentence the sort of the problem with this book is this is not how anything works.
Yeah, I know.
What Rand is positing is that there are great people in the world, inventors, philosophers, artists who are able to invent on the basis of their own talent and will. And that's all that's required, and that they owe nothing to anyone else. You know, everything springs fully formed like Athena from the head of Zeus. And it's not the way science gets done. It's also not the way music gets done. That one of the things that she talks about throughout this book is Dagny keeps hearing
Haley's Fifth Concerto.
There's this missing composer named Haley who is brilliant. And also she posits a world in which everybody knows who the contemporary
opera writers are.
Right. Everywhere people go in this book, everyone's noticing them. It's like, you know, aren't you Dagny Taggart?
I mean, I think if you saw people in a crowd today, people go, hey, that's Bill Gates.
Well, this is the thing. When I was reading this through, all I could think of was actually Elon Musk.
Yeah, yeah.
Elon Musk is a similar figure to the figures in this book in that he is considered to be this super genius by virtue of running an auto company. And because of that, people treat him as though he should be, and he treats himself as though he's someone who needs to comment on everything else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And his observations tend to be embarrassingly bad or strange or idiosyncratic. And I don't know why anyone feels that success in one field is going to translate into success in all fields.
He didn't start the company. Like,
there is a myth in America of the way invention gets done, and that all goes back, I think, to Thomas Edison, who was able to control his own story very much. He had this company that produced all these miraculous inventions.
And he bought out patents, and he had 100 engineers working for him, too. Like
he completely took credit for all the work of all the engineers that were working for him, and everything that bears his name, you know, maybe a couple of those things he was directly involved in. But that myth continues to this day, and that's one of the things I think that drives a lot of the bad laws around intellectual property in this country, in that people tend to think that, oh, we have to reward genius where it exists, otherwise the people won't be motivated to create things.
I mean, scientific discovery comes in, you know, assembling a lot of work that other people have done, and maybe sometimes you can put a novel spin on it, but you're always standing on the backs of other people who've done other things to contribute to your understanding. It's never just a lightning bolt and it's only you. And the amount of resources that go into just any sort of discovery these days are extraordinary. Like, so you just couldn't do it if you're a single guy writing out an engineering diagram, which is why all people in physics get so annoyed that they keep getting, you know, angry letters from cranks saying, no, I've solved relativity. Like,
right.
There's so much into the learning and doing the actual research. It's not a job for one person.
Well, I'm sure that Rand would have some very salty words for both of us. There is actually a point towards the middle of the book where Dagny's brother, Jim Taggart, who nominally runs Taggart Railroad, although he doesn't really do anything, he's talking to this woman, Cheryl. His future wife, and expressing jealousy for Reardon's great discovery of Reardon metal. And he says, "Reardon, he didn't invent smelting and chemistry and air compression. He couldn't have invented his metal, but for thousands and thousands of other people, his metal. Why does he think it's his? Why does he think it's his invention?"
I read that and going, but that's true.
Right. No, it is true. But Jim is being held up, of course, as an example of a dishonorable man, because all that Jim does is worry about what other people think of him.
Well, the other thing that I think is really bad is she talks about how the state scientific foundation is bad and the true ingenuity is in commercial stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, the reason we have human insulin as a product, as a drug, is because of basic scientific research into the genetics of E. coli and how we can modify them to insert the human gene to make them express our protein, our human insulin protein. And now we do it with yeast. We do it with Saccharomyces cerevisiae, baker's yeast. And all of that stuff came from governmental and nonprofit work, you know, academic work looking at basic things about biology. And then Eli Lilly commercialized it and patented human insulin, that kind of thing. That happened. But all the stuff that made it possible was nonprofit and state financed.
And typically the people who are most successful in capitalist ventures are the people who can come along when there has been a major scientific discovery or a major technological invention. The internet is a great example. The internet was funded by the Defense Department and by educational institutions. It grew out of the Defense Department looking into protocols for transmission, specifically around the idea of what you do if the country is hit by nuclear bombs and you need to reroute traffic. Built into that were a bunch of universities who had mainframe computers and thought, wouldn't it be keen if we could communicate with other universities? And it was chugging along happily during the 60s and 70s. TCP/IP was invented. And in the early 90s, HTTP, the protocol that the web is built upon, was also invented in an educational context. And then suddenly along come all these companies, Amazon, Netflix, et cetera, that build their wealth on the fact that there exists an infrastructure that was largely a public works project.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about as nerdy as I'm going to get. I'm sorry. I apologize to everyone out there. So to get back to the book, though. So I was saying earlier that it's fabular in the sense that on the one hand, the characters live their lives at such a high pitch. Dagny, she's ex-lovers with Francisco. What's his name?
D'Anconia.
who was this playboy millionaire. And then she falls for Hank Reardon. And then she gets involved with John Galt. And by the end, like, random characters are admitting to her that they loved her. Late in the book, her assistant, Eddie Willers, says, "You must know how I've always thought."
He's been friend-zoned for 20 years, apparently. Like...
Well, everyone desires Dagny.
What I find so impressive is everyone desires her, they love her, and then they're all absolutely fine with her being with someone else.
Like, well, because John Galt
is the epitome.
It's the epitome. It's like she keeps trading up for the more rational, more successful person. But the other thing that I found really strange about this book is it's remarkably unstuck from any kind of geographical sense-making. The characters move from location to location with great ease, and there's never...
Oh, right. It's like that last season of Game of Thrones.
Right. There's never any explanation of how much time it took them to get from one place to another. Late in the novel, Dagny is going by train to find out why one of her... subordinates is doing what all the other industrialists is doing and quitting mysteriously. Like, all these great minds across the country are quitting and disappearing from society. And she takes this train, and the guy that she meets there says, "Oh, he just left in this plane." And then she climbs into a plane, and suddenly she can fly a plane.
Yeah, I know.
And you're like, where did you could give us like a sentence or two about how she learned to fly the plane, but the way that Rand describes it is sort of like she's just so brilliant she understands it.
You know, I actually think when she's doing the plane, two things that I actually found a little bit exhilarating were the plane scene and the first train ride on the John Galt line. But it's actually sort of exciting. There's actually a moment in the book where you're going, "Whoa, something's happening, and it's serious." But my understanding is that the airplane scene is totally inaccurate about how you would fly a plane, and the John Galt line, the first ride of it, she describes racing to the stop and coming down this hill to get to the final push, and it's like all the weight of the train is behind you. But the reality is, you have to be braking for miles in if you're going downhill on a train that was going 100 miles an hour. Like, it should have been nothing but squeaking.
Right.
And instead, it's just this exhilarating of it perfectly coming to a stop from 100 to zero, you know?
Right. Well, the other thing that happens is Dagny crashes that plane.
Yes.
And walks away from it with, I guess, a twisted ankle.
And some contusions, minor contusions. Yeah.
Right. We're talking about a prop plane in the 1950s. She would have been splattered all over that. But fortunately for her, she lands right in the midst of Galt's Gulch and finds John Galt, who she's been searching for for the past two-thirds of the novel.
And it's, you know, I'm normally in favor of alliteration, but Galt's Gulch is hard to say.
Yeah. So, you know, we're not going deep into the plot of this book. It's got a confusing plot, and the basic gist of it is we're in a dystopian United States where everything seems to be breaking down, and part of the reason everything is breaking down is the government is regulating or taxing, they're nationalizing everything. And in addition to this, all the great thinkers of the world seem to be disappearing one by one. People are mysteriously like bankers and industrialists, and mostly industrialists. Let's be honest. It's mostly people who run factories.
Yeah, there's an occasional actress in the valley or something as well, but
they're all disappearing, and no one knows why. And for some reason, people keep asking this question: who is John Galt? And this is a thing that kind of bothered me about this book, is before I had read this, I was familiar with the line, "Who is John Galt?" And I knew that it was a line in this book because people have a lot of T-shirts out there that say, "Who is John Galt?" I was so let down by...
It's just such a lame phrase. It doesn't...
And Rand seems particularly pleased when she actually introduces the real John Galt into the book, as though we're all like, finally! And I'm like...
But like, how does the phrase even develop? It wasn't like he was a well-known person that disappeared. Like,
well, it's because we live in a world where the inventors, you know, people collect inventors' baseball cards, I guess.
I mean, he wasn't even running the engineering department at the motor company he was working at. Like, he was literally a no name, and that all of a sudden, every tramp in the city says, "Who is John Galt?" to signify their existential despair. Like, what?
but Galt also, in addition to inventing the static electricity motor, in a flash of pique at the fact that he was not going to reap the benefits of his own discovery, and that the company that he was in was going to have the gall to pay a living wage to all of its employees, he suddenly developed the philosophy of this book that's, you know, it seems to, in this book, everyone who is a brilliant mind and an industrialist is tending towards this philosophy anyway on their own. They're already developing a healthy disgust for people who do not produce miraculous inventions. They are proud of the fact that they work motivated by their own desire for wealth or personal adventure. They are all super kinky and and like rough sex.
They like some rough sex without consent talked about beforehand, and that's just not cool. But I don't know what influence that has had on my sex life, but reading that in eighth grade, it was very startling. Like, it was, any description of sex when you're in eighth grade is going to be fascinating to you, and this was like way out there. Like,
one of the first books I ever read when I was a young boy that went into sex in any detail was by Richard Adams, the guy who wrote Watership Down, wrote a book called Maya, which is not as well known, that has just the weirdest attitude towards sex. And if you read one of those things, one of those passages when you are young and still a virgin, it'll mess you up for life.
Well, I'm glad we've had this unique insight on both of our parts here.
Yeah, Dagny likes it rough.
And the sexiest thing about a woman can her being in chains. That's a quote from the book.
You know, as you read this book, you really get the sense that Rand is shot through with a lot of misogyny.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
But she likes to see herself as the, you know, she's not like other girls. She's the one, she's the smart one, and she understands what truth is, and she's attracted to brilliant minds, so she's okay.
Yeah, it's really clear in The Fountainhead, I think, especially, that she views women as never can being an equal of a man, but they can pick a great man and be a reflection of that man. And honestly, that's probably what helped me not buy into it so much, because I was like, well, that's pretty anti-feminist and stupid. Like, but is she... And just to go back to the sex scene things as well, she was asked at an author interview in like a bookstore, how do you write such great sex scenes? And she said wishful thinking, which is like one of the most human responses she could make, because the book is so human and humorous, because the book is so humorless normally too.
I think that's a good point to make about this, is whether or not you find any of the philosophical points that Rand is trying to make compelling or convincing, this is a humorless book. This is a book that is utterly bombastic. You talked about those scenes on the train or the plane as being exhilarating. I think that what Rand is trying to do in her prose is she's trying to evoke some sort of a muscular heroism around industry and her admiration for industry, coming from the Soviet Union.
Well, even from a richer background in the Soviet Union, you come into New York in the 20s and there are skyscrapers. That's going to be an astounding thing to take in. Like, just in terms of, like, I understand why she's writing about iron ore being so beautiful, being smelted. When you think of that, people need houses, and then you build these giant, fantastic skyscrapers. Like, that is human ingenuity. That is impressive.
It's very understandable where Rand is coming from. But what is disturbing is the intensity with which she argues her points and the lack of humility, the way that she feels everything that she's positing is obvious. And on the one hand, she is promoting objectivism as a synthesis of Western thought, an ethical imperative behind capitalism. She desperately sees this, her message, as an ethical one. But there's no, she brokers no dissent, and she presents every alternative. It's not just that people are misleading themselves or mistaken. It's that they are actively lying. At the end of the book, John Galt is being interrogated by the government and tortured.
And they want to torture him, by the way, so that he will become their central planner.
Right. He like. They want to make him the dictator of America, basically. They say as much. They say,
yeah,
you know, take over, lead us, you know. And Galt is like, no, you fools,
you can force me to do things, but you cannot force me to think.
There's a moment where Galt heroically, while he's being tortured, the machine breaks down, and as a sign of how little they've broken his spirit, Galt tells the engineer on hand how to fix the torture machine. And at that moment, Jim Taggart...
He collapses.
He collapses because he has to admit to himself that he has been lying to himself all along and that he is not motivated by a desire for altruism when it comes to collectivist impulses, that he is motivated entirely by the fact that he hates people who are actually producing beautiful things.
Yeah, because he's a nihilist. That's the lesson. He wasn't... Or perhaps that altruism and nihilism are the shades of the same thing, you know?
Let's talk a little bit, I guess, about John Galt's speech.
You know, I'm going to confess, I just skipped it this time around. I read it in eighth grade. I wasn't going back. I was... I was just going, nope, I can't.
Right. So late in the book, as society is collapsing around them, they never really say what the head of the government,
Mr. Thompson,
is going to give a radio speech that's going to set everyone's mind at ease, and then that's the airwaves are taken over by Galt using some unknown technology. And again, the way it's described is one of the engineers says it's coming through on a frequency no one has ever known before.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait, what?
We know all the frequencies. We know them.
We've known the frequencies of the electromagnetic spectrum since like the 1800s. But beyond that, if you're coming through on a frequency that is not within regular radio...
Then how are they receiving it?
Yeah, exactly. No one's going to hear it. Galt launches into a long discussion of the philosophical points of the book. He's going to... And this goes on for, I don't know, 300 pages or something like that?
I think it's 50, but yes.
But he's going to explain what all this means. And one of the lines that is used over and over in Galt's speeches is, A is A.
Right, and it's an Aristotelian thing about what is true is obviously true.
It's an argument that objectivists like to use, because one of the things that objectivists find reprehensible is the idea of relativism, that there would be any possible
gray area to anything.
Gray areas to anything. Everything has a right and a wrong. And if you don't acknowledge that, then you are more evil than anyone else because you are denying truth. My wife, Marina, is a professor of philosophy, and I was actually talking about this with her this morning, and she gave me a little bit of the background of Rand was really responding specifically to the epistemology of Immanuel Kant. You know, Kant, I know Kant primarily as an ethicist, but he had this very influential formation where he pointed out that we don't know anything. We can't conceive of the world except as it exists in space and in time. And because of that, we are always going to be, our conceptions of things are always going to be mitigated by our point of view. And the idea of things in themselves is not you can't really approach it. This is a central question I think people have often about things like science and math, is like, when you discover something in math, is that something that relates to the world, or is that something that is simply a fabrication that humans have come up with?
Right. Are we getting that objective truth truly, or are we just using a different framework to evaluate it?
Rand is stating, no, there is an objective truth. And
she knows it.
Right. And it's self-evident. This is really an appeal to common sense rather than anything else, as the idea that, well, obviously, you know that this is what's true. And I feel like, no, there's lots of things in life that aren't obvious. You know, you look at the sun, it looks like it's going around the earth. You know, it isn't. But that's what would obviously seem to be the case. But beyond that, it's really begging the question. And here I mean it, begging the question in the sense of it's arguing a point from itself.
Correct, you know,
So if you say A is A, to try and say, I know that A is A, and the proof I'm giving for it is A is A. Maybe
right.
I'm
not. No, I know. That's what I was saying earlier about confirmation bias. It's looking at things and saying, my interpretation is correct because it's self-evidently correct because I made it, and my mind is the greatest thing in existence.
Right.
Which is a very attractive thing to tell a high schooler. I will say that.
It is absolutely attractive to high schoolers. I think that high schoolers are among the most black and white thinkers that there are. And there's a point you get to around, I don't know, 15 or 16, when you're absolutely dangerous. You know enough about the world that you've decided that grownups are a bunch of phonies, and you've made enough opinions about the world that you think, yeah, I've got it all figured out. You know, if you're lucky, you will go on in life either to college or to a job where you will...
You'll get exposed to other ideas and viewpoints, and yeah.
You will get your mind's ass handed to you.
Right.
There's a lot there in Galt's speech, but it boils down to the idea that humans are marked by reason, and reason is the ultimate tool. It has some of Rand's most racist imagery in this section, where Galt is complaining about all kinds of native people and like witch doctors and pygmies and how horrible they are. It's kind of disturbing.
You're absolutely right. I didn't really remember that part, and because I also skipped that part this time. But I mean, Ayn Rand was probably very racist too. I mean, I think her point is, to some extent, like, I think one of the greatest things human beings have ever accomplished is come up with a scientific method. Because that has enabled so much of our advancement of things that we can do now, right? In terms of medicine and architecture or what have you. But she doesn't apply it to herself. She's saying reason is the highest thing, but she can't. Her hypothesis is non-falsifiable. And so she's rejecting it, but she's saying she isn't. And that drives me nuts. But when she talks about reason, she's going, oh, well, they didn't have the scientific method. That's what she's doing. But just totally ignoring that she doesn't use it either.
There's a line here at the end of the talk. Galt says, the source of property rights is the law of causality. All property and all forms of wealth are produced by man's mind and labor. As you cannot have effects without causes, so you cannot have wealth without its source, without intelligence. And this is an interesting claim here. She's so close to Marx here.
Yeah, but so far.
But then she goes a different way. She leaps over labor and then says, you can't have wealth without the person who thought it up.
Or labor, or even just the idea that... You know, Alice Wyatt didn't just like he didn't make the oil that he found in Colorado in the book. You know, like that's a natural resource that either belongs to no one or everyone.
Apparently, the motivating incident that caused Rand to think about this book was she was talking to a friend, and the friend was talking about a strike that was going to go on. And Rand said, well, what if I went on strike? What if all the brilliant minds went on strike? And this is sort of an inversion of the traditional strike. Strikes are traditionally labor telling management, we're not going to provide labor. And this is management telling labor, we're not going to provide management. And she has this fantasy that that would cause the world to absolutely crumble and that the cities would burn.
As opposed to when we saw factories being abandoned during the recession in 2008, like in Argentina, they collectivized some of them and kept them running. Like, you don't always need the boss. Like, and the thing is, the industrialists here are all brilliant engineers and scientists and innovators. But the reality is, that's not really true of who's always owning a business.
Very early on in my education, some teacher told me economics is the study of how resources are allocated. I think that that's true, but it's also the study of how wealth is divided. And what I don't think laissez-faire capitalists get is that wealth is a resource and resources are a form of wealth. If you've got wealth to sit on, you can negotiate very unfairly with people. If you're life is not in existential threat from food insecurity or from
housing insecurity or, yeah.
It's very easy for you to negotiate with people. If people are free, absolutely free, to move their goods and services around and move their labor around as well. You know, I don't want to belabor the point with macroeconomics 101, but it is frustrating that Rand presents her arguments as though they were self-evident. And I feel like I am not an economist and I am not a philosopher, but I can very quickly come up with
reasons why these things don't work. Like, well, even her view of what creates civilization and what means civilization, like, I'm going to butcher it, but it's the Margaret Mead, I believe, where she's talking about what the first sign of civilization is. And it wasn't finding ancient writing or finding, you know, ancient buildings or architecture. It was, you know, 200,000 years ago, seeing someone, finding a, you know, a skeleton with a broken bone that had healed. Because that meant people had stayed with the person and helped them, and so they fixed their bone. Like, it was actual our civilization and us as humans is defined by mutual aid. And she just totally ignores all history to come up with her idea of what it is.
I mean,
it's a non-evidence-based worldview, and which is what's funny, because that means it's a faith. And she doesn't perceive of it as such.
Ultimately, laissez-faire capitalism, objectivism, these are attempts to say, not only are attempts to work collectively doomed to fail, it's actually much better for people if government does nothing. It's much better for people if there is no regulation of anything. Early on in Galt's speech, he says, whatever may be open to disagreement, there's one act of evil that may not, that act that no man may commit against others and no man may sanction or forgive. So long as men desire to live together, no man may initiate. Do you hear me? No man may start the use of physical force against others. In this book, the villains of this book are the government that wants to create these weapons of mass destruction, this Project X.
There was F and an X, right?
Right. It's, well, F was the one that that tortured Galt, and X was the
sound waves, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, they called them sound rays.
Oh, right. Whatever. Which,
again, sound, not a ray.
No.
but I feel like what she's saying is, if we're all noble people who are motivated by self-interest, we will nonetheless abide by this edict to not use force against each other. And I'm like, why? Why does she believe that people are not going to use force against each other? She's, you know, it's this sort of prisoner's dilemma thing. I feel like that's such an oddly naive thing for Rand to say, considering that she has such a jaundiced opinion of humans and their compassion for one another.
Well, additionally, just the it's a really narrow view of what force is. If you know, it doesn't include economic force or anything like that, with, you know, being used against people. But also, like, it clearly doesn't apply to women, because women are just expected to submit to the men in their lives. So
it feels to me like objectivism is ultimately about this excuse to do nothing and to feel noble about doing nothing. And it reminds me very much of the current administration's approach to COVID. It is this fantasy that doing nothing is the right thing.
Because the market will fix it.
It'll go away on its own. The market will fix it, whatever. There are crises large and there are problems systematic that require a collectivist impulse, because they aren't going to be addressed otherwise. And the idea that, yeah, whatever, you know, that ultimately things are going to turn out better if you leave them alone is utterly ridiculous. Since the beginnings of capitalism, people who advocate for capitalism like to say it's the natural form. It you know, it's been around.
We've had all sorts of economic systems, you know.
Capitalism sort of emerges in the 17th and 18th century with the
end of feudalism and the.
If you go through the 18th and 19th century and follow the markets, since there have been publicly traded shares, there have been economic collapses, major economic collapses, regularly, almost every 20 years since the get-go. And it has only been since the careful regulation of financial markets following the Great Depression that we haven't had these enormous collapses. And that's because wealth tends to pool, and people who have wealth tend to take whatever...
As much as they can, yeah.
And part of that wealth is real in the sense that it is associated with labor or goods, and part of it is valuation.
And if you have people making the valuations who are invested in making money based on their valuation.
I'm not here to advocate that we drop capitalism in this country. I think that there are many good things about capitalism. I do think that it's a great motor for creating wealth. I don't think it's a good engine, though, for distributing wealth.
No, and I don't think it's a good one for handling things that are, for example, healthcare. You know, I think the for-profit healthcare industry is designed to prevent people from getting healthcare and maximizing their returns. Like,
okay, so what we're saying is that Bridget and I are a bunch of commie pinkos.
Yeah, definitely, sure.
And yet we read this book.
Well, and also, if you remember, I'm part of the regulatory structure right now. Like, my job pays me money to make sure, like, things are safe, you know? Like, I'm deep into the moocher or whatever thing. Like,
and my podcast is built on everyone else's work. I must be a moocher, too, or a looter.
It's true. I don't think there were any critics in Galt's Gulch.
I remember back in the, 2001 or something like that, there was a comic that went around the internet. It was a Bob the Angry Flower comic called Atlas Shrugged 2, which was like what happens 2 hours after the end of this book. And it's basically all the characters are sitting around. And they're saying like, well, who brought along the army of robots to till the soil? And they say, no, nobody. And goes, what? We have to till the soil ourselves? At one point in the book, they talk about how that since the trains aren't running, the wheat can't get to the...
To everyone. Yeah, like in Minnesota, they lose the whole wheat crop, and because the soybean crop from an experimental thing was bought out on a government favor, and so that got the trains instead.
It's telling that Rand's visions of who the real producers are does not include real producers.
And these real producers will magically be excellent pig farmers. Like, like every job has a skill, and it has to be learned, and you can't just go from being a banker to a pig farmer with nothing in between. Like,
unless you're Dagny, in which case you can go from running a railroad to flying a plane to apparently pulling off a daring gun rescue of your...
Right, where the security guards who were also armed are just intimidated by their sheer conviction and force of will. Like, we could just spend two more hours just making fun of this book.
But the funniest thing about this for me would be that this is a world in which people are convinced by argument.
I know. I kept thinking about that. Like, there's so much... So just a small personal anecdote. In my high school, Anthem and The Fountainhead were on the reading list for the English department. And that's because there was a teacher in my high school who loved it. She had all of Ayn Rand's nonfiction books in the back because, like, the Objectivist Society will just send it to you if you're a high school teacher. And so, but she also ran the debate class. And I remember giving a debate once where I talked about how we shouldn't have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I'm going, well, they agreed to the surrender terms that they were offering in the first place before the bomb dropped. So why did we do it? And like I mentioned a bunch of other things, you know, and eventually she was just like, no, it can't be that. And it's the same thing as this. It's going, the world can't be that way because I think it's this way. And there's no evidence and no argument that will ever change my mind. And that's kind of how people work. And it's sad, but it was really disheartening to hear the teacher who had told me that you could make a rational argument not change her mind. You know?
Any last words? Any thoughts on returning to Ayn Rand?
I don't know. It was a long week for me.
A week? Oh my God. How many pages do you read a day?
I was doing the audiobook at 2x speed, so I was just flying. And you know, I work in a lab, so there's a lot of time I can just put headphones on and work, you know.
You were barreling ahead just like Dagny on her train.
I know. It was, well, you know, the thing is, I really did remember a fair amount, and I was shocked by that because it had been so long. But I guess it was very formative to me at that time.
Thanks again to my co-host, Bridget Kennedy. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com and join in the discussion on either the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. I hope you all have a healthy and safe election. And when it's done, be sure to keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.